Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks, everyone. Appreciate you being here again on another Sunday morning. Sunday morning wake-up call. Today we're going to talk about Sexual Assault Resource Agency here in Charlottesville, also known as SARA. You can find them at saraseville.org. And our guest, the executive director at SARA, Renee Branson, and the director of outreach and philanthropy, Bass Wolf. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Sexual Assault Resource Agency. How long has the organization been around now?
We have actually been around for over 40 years now. So we have quite a history in Charlottesville.
And what's the difference between SARA, Sexual Assault Resource Agency, and the Shelter for Help and Emergency, also known as SHE? When would somebody call or use the services of one versus the other?
That's a great question, because sometimes there is an overlap, right, between sexual assault and intimate partner violence, which the Shelter for Help and Emergency that's their main focus. Domestic, it's also known as domestic violence. But we know that sexual violence and domestic violence often are happening at the same time. So we do collaborate from time to time when both things are occurring. But the SHE shelter is a great resource in town when someone is experiencing some kind of intimate partner violence, domestic violence within the home, within their relationship. And the Sexual Assault Resource Agency, we see folks who have experienced some kind of sexual violence or sexual assault. And we see men, women, children, non-binary folks, and just walk with them through that journey of the healing process after that assault.
The Sexual Assault Resource Agency also has a 24-hour crisis hotline, correct?
That's right, we do. So that is something that is available to anyone if they need connected to resources, if they need, whether they're in some kind of immediate aftermath of something happening, or if they simply want some more information. And we rely very heavily on a great volunteer staff who helps us staff those lines. You know, to have something that's available 24/7 takes a lot of people power. So we have, for instance, some upcoming training, and actually Bass could probably talk a little bit more about that, you know, what it's like to be a volunteer, what the process is for that, to keep that hotline running.
Yeah, absolutely. Our 24-hour hotline number, just in case, and anyone needs it, is 434-977-7273. And that's a 24-hour hotline that's available for anyone. We also have our business line, which is textable. So that's another accessible kind of front door to the agency where people can text in if picking up the phone doesn't feel safe or comfortable at that time. But our hotline volunteers are a great base of support who kind of triage survivors into SARA and can provide around-the-clock care and emotional support and additional resources and services. So the 24-hour hotline volunteer training is starting up in January, and it's a 40-hour training, which sounds like a lot, but we pack in a lot of information and training to really prepare people to take calls, and that's starting January 10th.
So what's the process? I mean, do you need some sort of specific background? How do you, if a number of people walk up to the door and say, I want to do this, how do you determine who makes the cut?
Yeah, we welcome anyone to the training, and while we do some vetting of the volunteers ahead of time, the training also can provide community members with the resources and tools and information to respond to survivors in their lives. So whether or not someone actually ends up being a hotline volunteer, we welcome everyone to attend the training and to gain that information and tools to provide an empathetic response to survivors in their lives or at their workplace or wherever that may be. When volunteers go through the process of hotline training, we really encourage people to have a mindset that is based on growth and empowering other people to make choices in their lives that are good for them. So if someone feels like they're an empowering individual who is empathetic and a good listener, we definitely want them on the hotline if they're interested.
That's Bass Wolf, Director of Outreach and Philanthropy at Sexual Assault Resource Agency. That's Sarah. We also have Renee Branson with us today. She's the Executive Director. Renee, why is it, many people say it's scary to call a 24/7 crisis hotline. Can you, why is that? As someone who's never used any sort of service like that, why do people say that it's scary, and what should someone expect?
Yeah, that's terrific. I think, terrific question. I think anytime there is, it's an unknown, right? When I call this number, what am I going to have to tell them? Am I going to have to say my name? Am I, and identify myself? Am I going to have to recount what happened to me? Will anyone else find out? So all of these kind of swirling unknowns can make it a barrier for someone to pick up the phone. So what we like to affirm and reaffirm to folks who are thinking about calling in is that they're the ones in the driver's seat here. They can say as little or as much as they need to in that moment. And in that we meet them kind of in that moment wherever they are. And so sometimes it might just be, I just wanted to pick up the phone and see if anyone would actually answer. I just needed to know you were there, and that's all I'm ready to do at this moment. Then that's enough. Right. Some other folks might call in and really want to or be ready to say, hey, I want to take some steps towards healing, and what could that look like? And that then grows into a larger discussion. But the important thing is that they are in control. They don't need to, you know, like I said, as little or as much as they're ready to share, they're the ones who get to decide that.
Is Sarah gathering information such as caller ID or anything else that may be used in case it's determined that this is a more dangerous situation than just telling your, you know, than the, I never know whether I'm using the right word, than the victim sharing their story?
Yeah, so we don't track those numbers. But one of the things that we do is that we ask if they're safe in the moment, and so we do some kind of just initial, as Bass is saying, kind of triaging what they might need in the moment. And so, you know, Bath might be able to talk a little bit more about what that, you know, what that process looks like, that we try to make sure that we have a way to follow up if we sense that there is, you know, there is some safety issues. And we do safety planning, with folks who call if that need be. Bass, are there some things that you might want to add to that?
We have a great blog actually just posted this past week on our website at sarahseville.org that is titled What to Expect When Calling Sarah's Hotline. Because if you haven't called a hotline, you're right, Rick, it can be scary. And just the unknown of whether or not someone's going to pick up the phone, who's going to pick up the phone, what they're going to ask you, can be really intimidating. And for someone who might not have shared their story with anyone, particularly with anyone they trust, or if they have shared their story and it hasn't been received with belief and support, then reaching out to someone else is just that much more difficult. So we like to provide information up front. If someone's thinking about calling, they're welcome to read that blog and just get an idea of what calling Sarah is going to be like. You know, there are some cases where we would want to get someone more professional help in addition to Sarah if they are in crisis. And we will have that conversation about what kind of crisis they're in, what kind of service provider they feel comfortable going to, and then patch them into the call with consent. Generally, if someone's looking for support in crisis, if it's not around sexual assault, it's very rare that someone calls Sarah when they need someone else, but it does happen. And we will go through the steps and processes with our staff and volunteers so that if those situations come up, we can handle them appropriately and swiftly.
Again, Bass Wolf and Renee Branson from Sarah of Charlottesville, the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. Are all the folks answering the phone at Sarah, are they all women?
No, they're not. So I mean, I think the majority of our hotline volunteers and folks who are answering the phone are, but they aren't all. But we do also have sometimes our hotline is forwarded to the statewide hotline, and you know, it's kind of same there. There are you know, men, women, non-binary folks who are answering the phone, but probably it is kind of overall more women than not.
So, and this could work in either gender or non-binary, I suppose. But I guess the stereotype, and I'm assuming the percentage majority, is that sexual assaults tend to happen more frequently with a female being the victim slash survivor. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
So if you call and a male picks up the phone and someone hangs up because the concern is, I don't want to talk to a man. What is the case? What are the steps that someone at Sarah would go through if there was concern that that was just the wrong gender who answered the phone?
Yeah, that's, I don't mind answering that question, Rick, because that, you know, it does happen to me. I think most of the time it is helpful to have other people answering the hotline or available to answer. So if I get a call and someone says, I'd really rather talk to, you know, a woman or somebody else, sometimes people say somebody else and I kind of know, you know, they want to be passed along to one of our female or woman-identified staff members, that I will gladly do that, because just picking up the phone can be really hard, and sharing their story should be a safe and comfortable experience. So I do ask if someone kind of seems uneasy, and will certainly pass the phone along.
Again, Sexual Assault Resource Agency, they have a 24-hour crisis hotline, 434-977-7273. You can also learn more at sarahseville.org. And one of the things that I have found to be appreciative of over the years is when you go to the website, if you're in a relationship where you're afraid of someone looking over your shoulder, there's the quick escape button, so that when you click on that, it fairly, at least at the moment, takes you to the Weather Channel. although I guess it could take you somewhere else next time. But it takes you immediately off of the Sarah webpage if you don't want to get caught looking at that by someone in the room. So what are the charges for the service? Is this all, because there are other services that we'll get to throughout the hour, I would assume that the hotline doesn't cost anything. You're not going to ask me for my credit card before you put me through to someone.
All of our services are free and confidential to anyone accessing them. And, you know, that's really because we believe that survivors shouldn't carry the financial burden of healing from trauma, that the community should cover that. And so we do.
But there is also a process for helping someone, right? If some people who call more immediately after a sexual assault versus someone who's calling at a longer time frame after the assault, they're handled differently. Is that true?
Yeah, I think the options for them are different. In terms of, is there any one particular or a set of different processes that a survivor is offered? It really is very different and individual, depending on that particular person. So yes, if someone were to either call us on the hotline, or we receive a call from the emergency department saying that a survivor has presented into the emergency department, what we do is we help to explain to them their different options, the options available to them, and then they are the ones, again, in control over deciding what next steps they want to take. So, for instance, if it is something that's happened very recently, they decide in terms of whether they're going to bring in law enforcement, what they, whether they choose to have a PERC exam, which I think we'll probably talk a little bit more about later, but, you know, the different kind of exam options available to them. And so our job is just to make sure they know all of their options and then advocate on their behalf in support of those options and decisions.
Again, our guest today, Renee Branson, Executive Director at the Sexual Assault Resource Agency here in Charlottesville, and Bass Wolf, Director of Outreach and Philanthropy. You can find the 24-hour crisis hotline in a number of places, but today we have it for you, 434-977-7273. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. And thanks so much again for being here with us on another Sunday here at the Wren. Renee, tell me, do holidays and extended family time play a role in driving up the numbers of sexual assault?
I think it can, yeah. I think there are a lot of different factors. You mentioned, extended family time where people are in a home together. And that, you know, if the violence and abuse is occurring within the home, there's just more time that can happen. I mean, we also note that from, during lockdowns from COVID, that can increase the amount of risk. I think that there are also, anytime there are situations where that are stressful, that there's more likely to be situations that can increase risk of violence, particularly when it's within the family, or in that the familial setting. So yeah, I think we do see an increase. I think there's also not only a risk, a higher risk during holiday times. I think the holidays, even if an assault has taken place years in the past, holiday time can often trigger some traumatic kind of feelings around, particularly if it's again something within the family or an intimate partner, where these things tend to be kind of anniversary markers. And so sometimes the holidays for someone who's experienced trauma can be extra difficult.
Bess, I've always wondered, or recently come to wonder, I guess, has the definition of sexual assault changed over time? I don't mean in a legal manner, but just sort of in a cultural manner. And have the majority of folks accepted any change?
Yeah, I think, you know, definitions change with a lot of words, and that's usually around, you know, context and social understanding. So, for example, Sarah was started in the 70s and only in the early 80s started serving men and children. So just their own agency, kind of understanding of who is impacted by sexual violence and how they need services really expanded over 10 years. And more currently, the understanding of particular needs around sexual violence and harassment in the workplace, I think, is more of a public conversation, and allowing people to define their own experiences that is separate from what the law might say is also very much important, and I think has adapted over time.
You mentioned the workplace. How about social media? Can social media play a role in what I would assume has always been a stereotypically physical situation when you talk about sexual assault?
Yeah, absolutely. Social media and virtual platforms and the safety on those platforms are very particular, because oftentimes communication can be one-directional. And there's not really points for conversation in many virtual platforms. So violence and harassment absolutely percolate through social media at times. And they can also be great points of connection and self-care.
Yeah, I think particularly I was thinking about the question that you asked about social media, and then also about, you know, has the definition of sexual assault changed? I think just in the last, you know, certainly 10 or 15 years, particularly in the age of Instagram and different social media platforms, that the exploitation of folks, whether it is, you know, people have referred to revenge porn, so posting pictures of intimate photos as a means of attack and harassment, those things can certainly be considered a violence. So that's something that 15 or 20 years ago wouldn't necessarily have been thought of in the definition of sexual violence.
And I guess that's really what I'm trying to be taught about today, is that for a number of people, sexual assault is someone being physically injured. You've bruised someone, you have hit someone, you have attacked someone in a physical manner with hands or feet or you know, some device that has caused pain through the body, not through the brain, in not in some way. And I hope people understand what I'm trying to say when I say through the brain, but through the nerves that run in that specific manner. And now we seem to have expanded it to, I mean, would, you said revenge porn. That's hurtful.
Right.
But it's not, but it's a different form. And so I'm not demeaning it or diminishing it. I'm just saying that that's an expansion of the definition. And I'm curious as to whether or not, how many people, do you have any people fighting that back saying it's wrong, but that's not sexual assault?
Perhaps. Right. I mean, I think you could probably find people who have a, you know, a wide variety of their opinion on what counts as sexual assault or counts as, you know, but to me, what the bottom line of this is that it's about a person's bodily autonomy. Right. And so whether it is a explicit or intimate photo of them that's been shared with, you know, across social media platforms, that is a loss of that person's privacy and bodily autonomy. And it is certainly a loss of a person's bodily autonomy when they are physically battered and sexually assaulted. Physically. So yes, those there are differences, but at its heart, it's about that control and it's about a loss of one's own bodily autonomy. So that's the way I think of it. I don't know if Bass has some kind of other thoughts around that. But
well, let me ask Bass real quick, because Bass, one of the things that I saw you do, Director of Outreach and Philanthropy, is, and this is a way to turn into some of the programs that are offered, is, I think these are some of the newer programs, but coaching boys into men. Correct? Can you tell us about this? Because my vision of this is teaching males what is wrong and what qualifies as sexual assault.
Sure. So Sarah's the recipient of a recent grant that focuses on engaging men and boys in conversations around prevention. So these programs that I'm going to talk to you about are through our prevention program. And one of them, you mentioned coaching boys into men, and the other program is called 10 Men. And both of these programs are evidence-based, research-based, and have been implemented in other cities in the United States. So when Sarah's prevention programs look for new curricula to take on and to implement in our community, we look at the communities that those programs were in. We look at national scale kind of options and assess what might fit here in Charlottesville. So Coaching Boys into Men is a violence prevention program for coaches. It's designed to inspire their teams of young athletes, student athletes, to cultivate a team culture that prioritizes respect for themselves, for others, and for women and girls. Through the program, coaches are trained to lead their athletes through brief weekly activities and conversations that address themes like personal responsibility, respectful behavior, and relationship abuse. And the program offers coaches these physical cards, like conversation cards, that have tips and discussion questions and other helpful tools that lead them through 12 conversations to really build a culture of respect and empathy and responsibility with their athletes. And one thing we know is that student athlete teams are really, they're not as gender-based, you know, as they used to. They can be very much more co-ed than even just 5 and 10 years ago. So these conversations, while the program is called Coaching Boys into Men and does prioritize male athletes, We do adjust and include other teams. So the other program that I'd love to highlight is called 10 Men. And 10 Men focuses on creating advocates for prevention work. It's a group of men who are passionate about making our community safer for everyone. It's a year-long program that kind of creates a cohort of 10 men, and it's designed to empower them to create positive change in their community. So we look for nominations of men who are leaders, leaders in their community, in their family, and people who are really interested in learning more about preventing sexual violence and responding to sexual violence through creating safer, more empathetic communities. So those are two new programs that we have kind of launching in the community right now.
And again, we are talking with Bass Wolf and Renee Branson from SARA here in Charlottesville, the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. You can go to the website, saraseville.org, or if you know that you need the 24-hour crisis hotline and have faith that you can make that call, 434-977-7273. Bass, there are multiple other programs out there, and we can get into some of those during the rest of the hour. I want to know about one called For Loved Ones, because not everyone who uses SARA has been individually hurt through sexual assault, right? You are not the victim / survivor, correct?
That's right.
Sorry, go ahead. All right. We provide services as well to those non-offending parents and loved ones, and that can extend from calling the hotline to receiving advocacy and therapy throughout kind of their healing journeys, because we really know that those support people also need support that is individualized for them and their experience being affected by violence that a loved one has experienced, while also supporting that loved one. So oftentimes it's a parents or spouses who are calling and just trying to gather some information to support their loved one. And what we really encourage them to do is to listen, to communicate with their loved one without judgment, to be there if the survivor seeks medical attention or plans to make a report, just to offer to be there. Their presence can really offer support that that survivor needs. Physical support by visually being there, but also emotional support because they know their loved one better than we do. Another thing in offering support is to encourage survivors to get professional support from resources like SARA, but there are also national hotlines, and if someone's, listening from somewhere else, that there are nonprofits in their community. So the national hotline can connect them with resources in their community. We also encourage people to be patient, because there's really no timeline for recovering from trauma, and to avoid putting pressure on the survivor to engage in services or activities that they aren't ready to do yet. So, and then of course, self-care for everyone involved. Self-care is really important in following an assault, but also throughout the healing journey and in our daily lives, to take care of ourselves so that we can be there for other people.
Renee, Bass touched on this a little bit when he said, be patient. But I was going to ask, are there things that the friend or family member shouldn't do in this situation?
Yeah, I think one of the big things is to say or imply that there is, you know, there is a right or wrong path towards healing. So for a loved one, even out of, you know, out of every good intention, saying to a survivor, oh, you've got to go to the police, or you have to report this, or you have to do this. I want to acknowledge that that's probably really natural to want to say, to kind of fix it, right? Say, here's what you need to do. But again, we always go back to putting the control back in the hands of the survivor. And so as tempting as that might be to say, let me make these decisions for you, to make this better, that actually can slow down or harm or even stall that, that process, helping them understand the options and all of the different things that can, paths that they can take forward, is something that's great. But kind of taking them along by, you know, by hand and leading is probably the number one thing not to do.
Sunday morning wake up call here as we talk about the Sexual Assault Resource Agency here in Charlottesville, known as SARA, saraseville.org, and the 24-hour crisis hotline, 434-977-7273. Our guests, Renee Branson, Executive Director, and Bass Wolf, Director of Outreach and Philanthropy. Let's take a break, and we will return. And thanks again for being here with us today as we learn a lot about sexual assault from Renee and Bass from our local SARA Sexual Assault Resource Agency. Renee, let me ask, we were talking about what friends and family can do and something, a thing or two that they should try not to do. But if you're not sure that a sexual assault has really taken place, what should you be looking out for if you have thoughts that maybe something did take place?
So just to kind of clarify, I wanted to, so if you're concerned that something has happened to your loved one, or you are wondering if something has happened to you.
I guess break it down and go either way. But I was thinking about, I thought that maybe my coworker or my niece or someone that I'm close, have some close connection with, has changed their personality a bit. Maybe because I just heard this radio show, or maybe because newspaper articles I've read, or maybe because of conversation, I'm beginning to wonder if maybe there was some sort of sexual assault. They used to date so-and-so, and now they seem to be shy when that person comes up. I don't know. I'm asking, if I have concerns that someone has had sexual assault, what are some things I should be looking for before I go offering help and bringing up the topic?
Right. Well, I think the first thing that anyone can do anytime they see that a friend or loved one is exhibiting some kind of distress is a general authentic check-in, you know, and say, whether it's, you know, I've noticed, I just want to check in with you because I've noticed that, you know, dot, 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 whatever you've noticed that is of concern. And if you have that relationship then, with that person, that you can speak to them about that. And then opening that door, right, for them. And again, they can, it's up to them to decide whether they're going to walk through that door or not and say, yes, you know, I've been struggling with something happened. But in terms of, you know, I think in terms of going, like you said, directly to bringing up in the question, is something that you wouldn't want to dive in. But again, having those open door conversations, leaving that opening for them, and building some safety around them being able to, if there is a disclosure to be made, that they could. Beth, did you have some other kind of other thoughts adjacent to that?
No, I think my only other thought is that if you're suspecting that a child or elder is experiencing abuse or neglect, that reporting that is something that we would encourage.
Yeah, that is a great point. And that is one of the things, actually, one of the few caveats to calling our hotline. It's a confidential hotline, but when there is a situation that involves anyone under the age of 18 or an elderly or someone over the age of 60 or someone who might have some developmental disabilities, then that is that needs to be reported. And so there are some limits to that. So Beth is absolutely right. If you have a concern that there is a child or an older person who has experienced abuse or sexual violence, then that is something to report or follow up on a little bit more specifically.
What happens with individuals who are undocumented?
We don't ask about anyone's immigration status or citizenship status, and so all of our services are, you know, as Beth mentioned before, free and available to anyone who is within our, you know, lives within our service area. And so all of those services are free.
But what, Beth? What happens, or how do you answer someone's question? They call the crisis hotline. There's a sexual assault in discussion, and the individual is undocumented, or there's that belief from the hotline volunteer, and there's concern about going to the hospital or concern about reporting it to police. Because deportation comes up. So how does the hotline volunteer proceed?
Sure. Well, I think first we would go through what kind of concerns that survivor has and validate those because, you know, systems can move quickly and unexpectedly. And that's a real concern. So if someone does disclose that they are undocumented and are fearful of systems being involved, then we follow their lead on choosing to report or not to report, on involving, you know, certain systems like law enforcement or not. These really aren't our decisions to make. It's about keeping the survivor safe and both physically and emotionally safe. So we really take survivors' lead and try to support them in whatever decisions they make.
Some of the things, some of the programs that are out there with Sarah, again, sarahseville.org, emergency room accompaniment. Tell me about that.
So when,
share with the listeners.
Yeah, when a survivor presents to the emergency department, particularly the university hospital, where there is a forensic team, forensic nurses available, the nurses call Sarah, and we send an advocate who has extensive training, more than our hotline volunteers, and usually is staff members or volunteers who've been with the agency for a number of years. And those individuals are responding 24 hours a day to the hospital so that survivors have an advocate, an emotional support person to walk them through the process of the forensic exam, which can take several hours, and also through the reporting process. If they decide to report to law enforcement, the sexual assault advocate from SARA will stay there with them and be a person to catch any sort of, you know, details about communications or timelines or dates, if that's what the survivor wants. We also provide information about our follow-up services. Oftentimes, survivors have a follow-up medical appointment, and our advocates can attend those follow-up medical appointments with them if they so choose. And then after that kind of initial medical screening and appointments, SARA can be an advocate in the long term. And usually they get a more long-term advocate than their emergency room advocate. But we provide services from there. But to go back to the emergency room, it can be a very re-traumatizing experience. When evidence is being collected that involves someone's body, we like to have an advocate there available if the survivor wants, so that they have an emotional support person, because in circumstances where evidence is involved, nurses and law enforcement are required to remain in their role. And while they can be emotionally, you know, supportive and empathetic, they also have a professional standard and line that is drawn. So SARA advocates are there to provide emotional support at the emergency department through the forensic exams and follow-up appointments.
One of the other things that is coming up for SARA is, and I guess it ends on December 8th, is an online auction fundraiser, as Bass Wolf is the director of outreach and philanthropy. And you can go to the website, auctionforsarah.com, and there's some pretty cool stuff there. If you take a look at it, you want to tell us more?
Yeah, I'd love to. Our Giving Tuesday auction is really fun. So it launched on Giving Tuesday and goes through December 8th at 8 p.m. So you've got lots of time to get on there and see the things to bid on. There are experiences like a brewing workshop at Three Notch Brewing Company. They've donated a day experience to be in the brewery, learning how to brew beer, learning how to can beer, and you get to be involved in the whole process. They also cover lunch, and so that's a pretty cool experience. There's also a beginner's mixology workshop with Ian Glomsky of Fatase Spirits. So that's pretty awesome. There's things like water park passes and tickets to the Met Live at Paramount.
Bass, you obviously like your beverages, but you're skipping the falconry at Boar's Head.
Yeah, there is a really cool falconry experience. If you're into birds of prey, definitely check that out. That's an experience for people.
Not to knock the other things, because I like my beverages too, but it's not anywhere where you can go and have a falcon on your hand.
Yeah, definitely.
That
and it's
is
local.
True.
You don't have to travel far.
All right. Back to some of these other cool things you can bid on.
Okay, sure. So there is, you know, a beer and wine or a food and wine section. Local businesses have donated there some gift cards and baskets like Blue Mountain Brewery and Maya, Bodo's Bagels, of course, and the Champion Hospitality Group. Really grateful to folks at those places who have donated to SARA. Then there's a section called Gifts for You and Yours. And these are just some great things to gift over the holidays, like earbuds from Crutchfield, some Kendra Scott jewelry. We also have local jewelry and local art that's been donated by people right here in our community. And those are some really special pieces. So check it out.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Again, you can go to auctionforsarah.com. And you've got until December 8th. Or what time on December 8th does this close down?
8 p.m. on the 8th.
8 p.m. on the 8th. So take care of it and make your bid and help support the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. Renee, we touched on this early in the hour, and we got about 5 minutes left, so I want to come back to this. How do you help someone who is living with the person who has assaulted them?
Yeah, I that's a real, it's a real challenge. I think, again, if you are someone who knows someone in that situation, to be a support and let them know that there is, there's an open door for them to reach out to you, when they feel, safe to, maybe have some resources ready for them when and if they are ready to help them, do some safety planning or connect them with someone like Sarah or like the Shelter for Help and Emergency that can help them with some safety planning. But also to know that again, these things need to be at their pace. It often, when someone is in the home with the person abusing them, it is very difficult and very dangerous often to leave. And so, the inclination is to say, why don't you leave if it's that bad? You know, I don't understand. So making sure that that's not the message that you are literally saying or implying, that they are doing their absolute best to keep themselves safe. People who are in that situation have actually gotten very good at helping to keep themselves safe in the immediate, but having that open avenue, open door for them to be able to reach out when they need to.
Bass, as the director of outreach and philanthropy, one of the programs that I would assume falls under outreach is help with prevention, which includes in restaurants and schools and specifically working with teenagers. Can you talk about this specific prevention in these areas?
I can talk about the prevention. I will say that we have a separate prevention team that is directed by Lori Jean Talloon. And so while she is the expert, I'd be happy to touch a little bit on a couple other things that are going on with them. There's a program in restaurants. We have a kind of a coalition of restaurant managers, bartenders, and owners that's developing procedure for handling sexual harassment in the workplace. And this can be harassment between staff members or between staff members and patrons. So the team provides consulting and training to help managers and staff intervene in risky or dangerous situations. That's a really cool program. We've got a lot of community partners involved, and that's been going on for a couple of years now. We also have a program called called Safe Church, and that is a program in faith and religious communities focused on getting faith communities support, training, and policy guidance on empowering congregations to prevent child abuse. So that's a really important program that our prevention team does. And then the last one I'll mention is parent council. We have gathered a group of parents who have come together to guide our prevention team and prevention in the region using their peer support and experience as parents. So it's a peer learning group that creates space for parents and guardians to learn in a safe, supportive environment while also allowing Sarah staff to facilitate conversations about how to be an ally to your child and what children need to know at each age in terms of like setting boundaries and emotions coaching. But the parents are very much involved in these conversations, and we're looking forward to hopefully showcasing the parent council within the next year or so with a community event. So, if you're interested in that, in any of these programs, we've got more information at sarahseville.org/prevent.
Renee, we have 60 seconds left. What is the next program that Sarah wants to make happen?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I mean, I think in terms of adding new programs, you know, I don't know that we'll expand our core programs yet, but really one of the programs that we didn't get a chance to touch on is really goes back to one of the things that Bass was saying in terms of being patient in the healing process. And that involves, we have long-term counseling available with our highly trained trauma therapists who provide free long-term trauma counseling for survivors of sexual assault and their loved ones, if that's needed as well. And so that's something that is a really important part of the long-term healing journey for survivors.
And you can find lots of information out for much of what we didn't get a chance to discuss today at sarahseville.org. If you need to call the 24-hour crisis hotline or know someone who does, 434-977-7273. Our guests, Renee Branson, Executive Director, and Bass Wolf, Director of Outreach and Philanthropy today from Sarah. Folks, thanks so much and appreciate your time and your commitment here in the community.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. Hopefully we'll have you here again next Sunday. Bye.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.